and that it's fans of another more famous author of high-concept science fiction. So we put it on all the posters, and there's a big campaign all over the underground, and it's on the front of the book, and it's too late to change any of it.
Oliver was looking perplexed in a way that made me want to hug him.
That seems unalloyedly positive, Bridget.
It would be.
She threw herself into the nearest free chair.
Except the more famous author in question was Philip K. Dick, and the pull quote was, "If you like Dick, you'll love this." And no one spotted it until we started getting extremely disappointed reviews on Amazon.
Peter glanced up from the Ferrero Rocher carnage with an expression somewhere between playful and speculative.
Just out of curiosity, how are the sales?
Surprisingly good, actually. I think it might have crossover appeal.
She spotted me.
Oh, Luke, you're here.
I grinned at her. I'm a plus one.
I don't believe it.
Jennifer Wimbledoned between me and Bridge.
Oliver brings his new boyfriend to my party, and I think, finally, I beat you to relationship gossip. Then it turns out you've already met.
Bridge looked, and there's no other word for it, smug.
Of course. Luke's my best friend, and Oliver's the only other gay man I know. I've been trying to get them to date for years.
Chapter 37. It took about 10 minutes, but eventually we all managed to cram ourselves round a dining table that was strictly designed for 6, 8 at a push, and taking the piss at 10.
I will admit,
said Jennifer, as she wheeled a desk chair in from God knew where,
I was slightly banking on a couple of people cancelling at the last minute.
Brian manoeuvred his mead glass into position amongst the tangles of cutlery.
At the very least, you'd think Oliver would have driven his boyfriend off by now.
With friends like you, Brian.
Oliver gave a sigh that I worried signalled more than amused exasperation.
Who needs opposing counsel?
At which point, Amanda elbowed her husband sharply in the ribs.
Get with the programme, dude. Right now we're in the happy for you space. In 6 to 8 days we'll be in the mocking you space.
Oliver had just enough room to put his head in his hands.
Please stop helping.
Anyway.
That was Jennifer.
Awkward as this is, I like to feel that slightly more friends than you can fit around your table is exactly the right number of friends to have. So I want to thank you all for having managed to avoid work crises, childcare emergencies.
Some polyphonic bells rang out from Ben's breast pocket, and he leapt to his feet, nearly clocking Tom in the head on the way.
Fuck, babysitter! I bet the little fuckers have burned the house down.
And with that, he ran out of the room.
Mostly avoid childcare emergencies,
Jennifer continued. Sophie finished her wine.
Darling, that's not an emergency. That's our life now.
Tell you what,
Jennifer made a fuck this gesture.
Let's pretend I did a speech. I love you all. Let's eat.
Peter sailed in from the kitchen bearing a tray of martini glasses full of gunge and lettuce.
To start, he announced in his best master chef voice, prawn cocktail. And I'm sorry, Oliver. We thought about you for the main, but we couldn't be buggered to do a veggie starter, so we just didn't put the prawns in yours.
You mean, said Oliver, I'm starting my evening with a glass of pink mayonnaise.
Wow, yes, we really screwed you on that one.
Bridge and Tom had been whispering quietly to one another, but now she looked up in confusion.
Wait a minute, why are we having prawn cocktail? Nobody's eaten prawn cocktail for 20 years. And actually, why are we all drinking Bacardi breezes?
Apparently.
Sophie had poured herself yet another glass of the good wine.
This whole party is non-consensually retro-themed.
Jennifer squirmed sheepishly.
The thing is, I didn't want people to feel pressured to do costumes or, well, make any effort at all, so I decided to make it a surprise. So, surprise!
We settled down to remind ourselves why people stopped eating prawn cocktail. Spoiler, the reason is because it's horrible. Fortunately, we all seemed to agree on that, so nobody felt compelled to politely eat it anyway.
"Don't worry," Peter began to clear up around us. "I think the main course should actually be edible. It's beef Wellington, except Oliver, who gets mushroom Wellington, which, I'll be honest, we sort of made up."
Oliver handed back his largely untouched glass of pink mayonnaise.
"Which is to say the main course should be edible for everyone except me."
"I'm sorry, Oliver."
Peter gazed at him with mock contrition.
"But you should have stuck at being our only gay friend. Trying to be our only vegetarian friend as well is frankly pushing it."
"You know," I said, "the mushrooms sound lovely. If there's enough, I'll have some too."
Bridge actually made a squee noise.
"And you used to be so grumpy and unromantic."
"I've never been grumpy and unromantic. I've occasionally been..." I tried to think of something. "Brooding and cynical."
"And now Oliver's brought out your inner marshmallow."
"I'm eating a mushroom, not jumping down the bleachers singing I can't take my eyes off you."
Jennifer toasted me with a Smirnoff Ice.
"Good on-theme reference."
We were just dishing up the Wellingtons, both of which were enormous, when Ben came back looking haggard.
"Drink me."
He collapsed next to Sophie.
"In the give me a drink sense, not in the Alice in Wonderland sense."
She drinked him.
"Everything all right, darling?"
"We're going to have to give Eva another raise. Twin A went missing and she looked all over the house for him and was about to call the police when she glanced out the window and saw him in next door's kitchen between the cooker and the knife rack."
"I take it he was fine?"
"Sadly, yes. Neighbours are a bit traumatised, though."
Sophie rolled her eyes.
"We'll send them a gift basket, you know, like the last three times."
We got on with eating for a while. Despite the warnings, the mushroom Wellington was honestly... fine? I mean, it would probably have been improved by the addition of beef, but then most things are. Unfortunately, this also brought us to my least favourite part of the meeting other people's social circles experience, the bit where they decide they've got to take an interest in you for the sake of their friend.
"You're," Brian kicked off, "some kind of rock star, is that right?"
I nearly lost a mouthful of Wellington.
"No, very much not. My dad's a rock star. My mum used to be a rock star. I'm like the opposite of a rock star."
"A scissors planet?"
suggested Amanda, after way less thought than it should have taken.
Yes. Or maybe no."
"That makes more sense."
Brian gently shifted his beard braids away from the gravy.
"I wasn't sure what a rock star would be doing with Oliver."
"What is wrong with you this evening?"
This was not Oliver's "you are teasing me and I secretly like it" voice. This was Oliver's "I am properly upset now" voice.
"Are you trying to make me look as unattractive as possible in front of a man I actually like?"
"Ignore him, Oliver," said Jennifer. "He's overcompensating for 10 years of being the single one."
Oliver still had that prim, icy look about him.
"I'm not sure that makes his behaviour acceptable."
"I'm sorry."
The table was too small for expansive movements, but it didn't stop Brian from trying.
"I really am. It's just you've dated a lot of people and they've never been right for you, and I want to know what makes this guy different before you get hurt again."
"I'm not your teenage daughter,"
snapped Oliver.
"And thinking about it, even if I were your teenage daughter, the way you're acting would still be deeply controlling and weird."
"He's right, dude."
Amanda gave her husband a disappointed look.
"You're being a prick."
I'm sorry.
There was a long silence. Until Oliver eventually sighed and said,
"It's fine. I suppose it's sweet that you care, in a profoundly unhelpful way."
I felt suddenly and intensely shit, because I was sitting here, eating these people's food and drinking their Bacardi, watching them be all excited and hopeful that their friend, who they obviously cared deeply about and who'd apparently been more miserable than I'd noticed, was finally happy. And the whole thing sort of still had an expiration date. For a while now, I'd been living quietly with the knowledge that I was probably going to be a bit messed up when, if this ended. It hadn't occurred to me that it might mess Oliver up too.
So,
Sophie changed the subject with the poise and dignity of somebody who'd drunk entirely too much to give a fuck.
If not a rock star, what do you do?
I'm a fundraiser for a charity.
Oh, of course you are. Oliver, why are your boyfriends always so drearily ethical?
Don't worry. I slanted a secret grin at Oliver. I'm not ethical at all. I used to be in PR before I got fired for becoming the story, and now I work for the only people who'll have me.
That's far better. Keep this one, darling. He's a lot more interesting than the others.
Yes. Oliver lifted a brow. Appeasing my evilest friend is exactly what I look for in a boyfriend.
You joke, but it should be.
Her attention flicked back to me.
What's your charity trying to save/prevent?
Dung beetles? She blinked.
Normally this would be obvious, but saving or preventing?
Actually, Oliver gave my knee a squeeze under the table. They're extremely ecologically important. They aerate soil.
My children are 6 miles away. I've had an awful lot of wine, and Oliver seems to want me to care about dirt. I'm doing my best, but...
Sophie wafted her glass solicitously.
Does anybody have a fuck I can borrow, because I'm fresh out?
The part of my brain that had actually been showing up to work recently kicked in before I could stop it.
Look, I can absolutely help you find a fuck to give, but I'm very aware that I'm at someone else's birthday party and probably shouldn't be fishing for donors.
No, please fish, Sophie.
Jennifer flashed a smile at me across the table.
She's got pots of money and doesn't deserve any of it.
Excuse me, I work very hard for my morally bankrupt clients.
But go on, charity man.
Sophie propped her chin on her palm and gazed at me challengingly.
Land me.
I gave Sophie a once-over. Remarkably together, despite the truly stupendous amount she'd drunk. From her choice of dress, she liked people to underestimate her, and from the way she spoke, she liked to remind them that they had. There was a strategy that would probably work here, but it was risky. Okay, I said. I'm guessing that you donate to charity for exactly 2 reasons, which are tax breaks and sticking it to your do-gooder friends. I could try to explain to you why dung beetles are a vital part of the country's ecology, but clearly you don't care, and that's okay, so instead I'll tell you this. Any asshole with a credit card can give money to puppies with cancer or toys for sad children, but nothing says I have thought about my charitable donations better than you have, like giving your money to an environmentally vital but fundamentally unattractive insect. In the who's best at philanthropy game, the person with the most obscure charity wins, always. And you do not get more obscure than us. There was a pause. A deeply uncomfortable pause that lasted just long enough for me to wonder how badly I'd blown it. Then Sophie's lips twisted into a gleeful smirk.
Sold. How much do you need?
Ben burst out laughing, and I wasn't sure where to go from here.
Great. That's great, but given you're really pissed right now and you're Oliver's friend and I don't want him to be cross with me...
I'm perfectly happy, he interrupted. Bleed her dry.
Even so, I do actually have some professional ethics. You can ring me tomorrow if you want, or I can call you and we can set up a lunch, or, you know, there's a big do next week where you can come and hang out with posh people and throw all your money at us if that's how you're feeling.
You have a dung beetle do?
Yeah, we call it the beetle drive. Aren't we adorable?
Another pause.
I feel compelled to point out,
said Sophie finally,
that you've just refused to take money from me now because I'm drunk. But you've invited me to a party where you presumably try to get a lot of people drunk and then ask them for money.
Yeah, it's not unethical if you print invitations.
Then I suppose I'll see you there.
The table broke into only slightly sarcastic applause.
Anyway,
Jennifer began to help Peter clear the table.
To bring things back to my birthday, do people need a pause before dessert?
Brian stroked his beard.
Very much depends on what dessert is.
It's a surprise.
Does that mean it's something we're all going to hate?
Ooh.
A thought struck Amanda.
Is it Angel Delight?
A different thought appeared to have struck Ben, who shuddered theatrically.
If it's Black Forest Gatto, I'm leaving.
The frozen dessert banter looked set to continue for a while, which a couple of people seemed to read as a cue to stretch their legs and take bathroom breaks. I was more or less happy where I was, but then Oliver leaned over and whispered to me that I should come outside a moment. Oh shit. I shouldn't have tried to develop his friend. What the fuck was wrong with me? Feeling distinctly chastised, I trailed Oliver into the hall.
Look, I started. I'm sorry I...
At which point, he pressed me against the wall and kissed me. It was fair to say we'd done a decent amount of kissing since putting it on the boyfriend menu, but it hadn't been like this since my guardian-related freakout. I was beginning to think dumping him had put him off me somehow, and while I'd have really liked to get back to how things had been that night on my sofa, the sweet, sharp certainty of wanting and being wanted, I'd been wary of pushing my luck. We hadn't managed to see each other for most of the week, and it was hard to expect a guy to look at you as a passionate and intensely sexual being when your last two meetings had involved crying on a bathroom floor and an exhibition of glass sculptures. But apparently, being moderately supportive at a party and trying to make one of his friends give money to dung beetles had done the job just fine. In any case, I was here for it. Very, very here for it. As, briefly, was someone else who told us to get a room on his way to the loo. But fuck it. These weren't yeah-whatever kisses. They weren't take-it-or-leave-it, get-your-coat-you've-pulled kisses. They were everything I thought I could never have. Everything I'd been pretending I never wanted. Telling me that I was worth it. That he'd be there for me and put up with me. And wouldn't let me drive him away. Oliver Blackwood was giving all that to me, and I was giving it right back. In the clutch of hands and the press of bodies and the urgent heat of his mouth on mine. And when it stopped, it still wasn't over. Because he sort of kept staring at me, his eyes all shiny as his thumbs brushed lightly over my cheeks.
Oh, Lucien. I take it you're not cross about Sophie, then?
On the contrary, it was very impressive. I hope you're not having a terrible evening.
No, it's really nice.
They like you, you know.
He kissed me again. More gently this time.
You can tell by the way they're being total dicks.
I laughed. I should probably introduce you to my total dicks as well.
I'd like that. I mean, if you think I'd reflect positively on you.
Oliver.
I was feeling way too soppy to give him a withering look, but I tried anyway. My friends know who I am. Of course you'd reflect positively on me.
Sorry, I just... I'm glad you came with me tonight.
Me too. I haven't had a Bacardi Breezer in years.
I paused, savouring his reaction. And this bit didn't suck either.
Well, I'm glad I at least outranked the prawn cocktail.
Pulling him close again, I nipped playfully at the edge of his jaw, where he was all stern and square.
We should go back.
Actually,
a faint flush darkened his cheeks.
I was rather minded to take you home.
Why? Are you not feeling... Oh.
I mean, if that's agreeable.
It was the wrong time, but I had to. I thought you said that wasn't the title of your sex tape.
I lied.
One of his little coughs.
Now... let's see if we can make our excuses and leave discreetly.
Having met Oliver's friends for all of 10 seconds, I did not rate our chances of running home to Shag without their knowing exactly what we were up to, and commenting on it accordingly. And I was super right. Chapter 38. The ethically sourced minicab that Oliver called to take us home took far too long to take us home, partly because I was, to use the technical term, horny, but mostly because the more I thought about it, the more nervous I was getting. Oliver had made it very clear that he did not take sex lightly, and I'd made kind of a lifestyle out of only taking it lightly. And, obviously at the back of my mind, I'd been hoping he'd eventually surrender to my naked animal charisma and give me one. But now that it was happening, it didn't feel quite like I'd thought it would. I mean, yes, it was exciting and sexy, and he liked me. He really liked me. But what if I fucked it up? What if I wasn't very good? I'd had no complaints, but nobody looked a gift blowjob in the mouth, so maybe, like every other aspect of my life, I'd just been coasting on other people's low expectations. The thing about a hookup, the thing I liked about hookups, was that it was pretty clear whose job it was to get who off. Those whos being you and yourself, respectively. When you, you know, cared about someone, you started caring about confusing nonsense like if it was good for them, and how they felt, and what it meant. And what if we got back to Oliver's perfect house, and we lay down on his perfect sheets, and we did the sex, and it was fine? I'd told him before that fine was all he could expect from me, and he'd said fine wasn't enough for him, and now it wasn't enough for me either. But what if it was all I could manage? Oliver was far too dignified to actually run for the front door, but he certainly got his hustle on, and we'd barely made it into the hallway before he was on me like I was a vegan brownie, and I was pulling him close, and we were kissing again. Which was great. We'd definitely got the kissing down, but also took everything I'd been stressing about in the taxi and made it horribly real and immediate. After all, this was supposed to be my bag. I'd spent years getting my debauch on, in and out of the papers, and yet here I was with a guy I was really into and really, really wanted to be into me, and I was reduced to the sexual sophistication of a teenager in a John Hughes movie. On the admittedly more than a few occasions I'd imagined getting to this point with Oliver, I'd been a creative and considerate lover and blown his mind with my astounding array of sex moves. Instead, I was clinging and grinding and making, if I'm honest, slightly embarrassing moaning noises. Oh God, help! This had no right to feel so perfect. Suddenly, Oliver's weight shifted, and, for a handful of awful seconds, I thought I'd put him off somehow. But then he hoisted me into his arms, and I was such a weird combination of relieved and lust-addled that, rather than asking what the hell he was playing at, I wrapped my legs around him like a twink in a porno. With a strength I shouldn't have found surprising given his commitment to a healthy lifestyle, he started carrying me towards the bedroom. It was this perfect, magical fantasy moment, right up until he pitched forward and dropped me on the stairs. I said, ow! Looking flustered and adorable, Oliver reversed off me like a minibus in a cul-de-sac. I'm so sorry, I don't know what I was thinking. No, it's cool. It was briefly very sexy and romantic. You're not hurt, are you? I'm okay. Bit self-conscious about being too heavy to carry. I'd been joking, but of course Oliver got terribly serious in case he'd accidentally body-shamed me, as well as accidentally body-slamming me. It doesn't reflect on you at all. I overestimated my ability to handle the stairs. Good to know. Now, will you stop being reassuring and fuck me? I will fuck you, Lucien. He'd gone all stern, and for once, it didn't bother me at all. In the manner of my choosing. I stared at him wide-eyed and blatantly into whatever this was. Steady on. I didn't sign up for 50 Shades of Gay. No, you signed up for me. Now go upstairs and get on the bed. I went upstairs and got on the bed. A few seconds later, Oliver appeared in the doorway, dropping his coat on the floor. And I mean, wow. I had never seen him not use a hanger. He must have been really into this. Into me?
I'm sorry, he said, blushing a little. I've never thought... I... That is... You...
Don't apologize. It's, interesting. He blushed even harder.
I've actually wanted to do this for rather a long time.
Just throwing this out there, I scowled at him. You absolutely could have, at any point.
I suppose I thought you were worth waiting for.
Shit, I hoped he was right. I'm not the last after 8 mint.
Well, no.
He joined me on the bed, crawling across the covers like a tiger who'd been to Abercrombie and Fitch.
If you were, we'd all be too polite to take you.
I'd have a witty comeback, but I'm kinda distracted right now.
You do seem, he said dryly, to be markedly less intransigent when you have an erection.
Yes, it's my Achilles penis. Laughing, Oliver started unbuttoning my shirt, which was, on the one hand, good, because it got me closer to naked, and therefore closer to laid. On the other hand, I was about to be topless, and it wasn't like Oliver hadn't seen me topless before, but this was one of those context-is-everything situations. Being naked and being made naked felt distinctly and scarily different. Normally, I didn't especially worry what my sexual partners thought about my body, but then normally my sexual partners were strangers. In an effort to balance the scales, I returned the favour and realised I'd made a tremendous strategic error, because while I got by on genetics, height, and walking to work, Oliver bothered to take care of himself. It was the sexual equivalent of someone getting you a really thoughtful Secret Santa gift when you knew you'd bought them a bath bomb. Should I go to the gym? I asked. Like ever. Because otherwise you're going to have to get used to me being monumentally average.
You are many things, Lucian. But you could never be average.
No, this is a physical thing, and believe me...
Stop it.
He kissed me, hard enough to smother my protests, his palm gliding over the exposed skin of my torso and leaving a pattern of fresh warmth.
You're beautiful. So beautiful, I can't believe I'm finally getting to touch you.
I wanted to say something suave and witty to show I was...
suave and witty, and not a pile of melt.
But all I managed was... Fuck, Oliver.
God.
His voice roughened.
I love how responsive you are. Look.
His fingertips spiraled up my arm and across my shoulder, goosebumps springing up in his wake like they were doing a stadium wave. I tried to make a noise that somehow signalled, yep, this is how I am with everybody, certainly not just you. But then his mouth got involved, laying pleasure over pleasure over pleasure, and I... Shit, I think I whimpered.
The things, he murmured, I've dreamed of doing to you.
I blinked. Maybe I could salvage this before I fell apart. Why? Are they filthy?
Nothing like that.
He pushed me onto my back, his hands unbuckling my belt and pulling off my jeans, boxers and socks in a flurry of very Oliver efficiency.
I just want to be with you. Like this. I want to make you feel things. Good things. For me.
He was gazing at me, with this terrible earnestness, meaning every word. And you know, it was fine. I could cope with this. I could have feelings. It was fine. Never mind that there was this sense of nakedness settling over me, strangely independent of the fact that I was actually naked. And never mind that every time he touched me, it was like he was unmaking me with tenderness. And definitely never mind that I needed this so badly I wasn't sure how to have it. Now Oliver was shedding the rest of his clothes, shirt and trousers and everything else, landing messily by the side of the bed. I'd almost forgotten what it was like for a moment like this to mean something. The first time you saw a partner undressed, how they both gained and lost mystery, the truth of them, all their secrets and imperfections, surpassing any fantasy you could have conjured. The strangest thing was that Oliver had seemed so unreal to me at first. I'd wanted him from the beginning, from that horrible encounter at that horrible party. But the way you'd want a watch in a jeweler's shop window, a kind of frustrated admiration for something distant and perfect and just a little bit artificial. But actually, I hadn't seen him at all. Only a reflected bundle of badly thought-out desires. And Oliver was so much more than that. He was kind and complicated, and more anxious than he let on, if his texting style was anything to go by. I knew how to make him angry, and how to make him laugh, and I hoped I could make him happy. Or maybe I couldn't. Maybe I was too fucked up. But Oliver had stuck with me through my dad's bullshit and my mum's curry. He'd held my hand in front of reporters and let me dump and undump him through a toilet door. He'd become one of the best parts of my life. And so I was fucking well going to try. I heard myself say. I want to be good for you too. I'm just not sure. He lowered himself over me, all heat and strength, and the perfect glide of skin. You are. This is. But I... Shh. You don't have to do anything. You're enough. You're... I gazed at him, not sure what was coming next. From the look on his face, he probably wasn't either. Everything. He finished. Well, this was... new. Having to deal with sex feelings and feeling feelings at the same time, teaming up to leave you all achy and open and hopeful. His mouth covered mine, half kiss, half groan, and I flung my legs around him to draw him in closer. He seemed to find this encouraging, which was good, because he was meant to, and soon he was driving our bodies together in this samba of promise and sensuality, his mouth painting me with shivery little kisses. And this was amazing, like, oh God, stop, oh God, never stop, oh God, level amazing. Except, for whatever reason, I couldn't work out what to do with my hands, and suddenly I had these enormous alien mitts floating around at the end of my arms with no clear instructions. I mean, should I have been trying to get at his cock? Or was it too early? Did he mind having his hair stroked? Or was that just weird? Was pulling it a bit much? Wow, his shoulders were really defined. I'd finally settled on spreading my palms fretfully over Oliver's back when he reared up, caught my wrists, and bore them gently to the pillow on either side of my head, which, admittedly, wasn't totally unhot. I said. Sorry. A flush crept down his neck and across his chest. I can't seem to help myself. It was strangely comforting to see Oliver even a little bit out of control, even if it was in quite a controlling way. And at least I didn't have to worry about my hands anymore, although that might have been cheating. It's... okay. I think I'm into it. I mean, I gave a shaky laugh. Not if you're going to pull out your leathers and start telling me to call you daddy. He nipped at my throat in playful rebuke. Oliver will be fine. His fingers curled around mine, unexpectedly tender, given he was on top and holding me down, as he leaned in for another kiss. I pushed against him, not because I wanted to get away, but to feel what it was like to be inescapably held. Not awful, as it turned out, when it was Oliver. My movements turned squirmy, and I heard myself moaning softly. And, God help me, needily, which was scary and embarrassing and weird. Please trust me, Lucien. In that moment I was sort of relieved and sort of horrified to hear the vulnerability in Oliver's voice. It's okay to have this. Then what are you having? You.
He smiled, eyes glinting silver. I'm rather enjoying having you at my mercy. And that was when I remembered something. How fucking good it could be. Just to be with someone. To let them see you. To be enough. How about... I strained up and kissed him. Well, bit him. Kissily. Less mercy, more having. He legit growled. And things got excitingly rough for a while, my self-consciousness fleeing with Oliver's self-restraint. I made a few token efforts to wriggle free, but he always distracted me, with my name on his lips, or some fresh touch to a place I never knew could be so sensitive, and by the time he stopped holding me down, I was too far gone to notice. There was only him and me, and the crumpling sheets, and the play of the streetlights through the curtains. I was pinned by the sheer pleasure of it all, of Oliver's ragged breath and the stream of his caresses, of his deep, deep kisses, ceaseless as the sky in summer, the drag and press of our bodies, the rub of hair and the glide of sweat. And the way he was looking at me, tender and fierce, and almost awestruck, like I was a different, better person. Although maybe, just then, I was. Chapter 39. What was I thinking? Not only had I agreed to meet John fucking Fleming at the busiest point in my working year, but now he was taking me away from my gorgeous nearly boyfriend, who would otherwise be sexing me silly. I guess I was just that good a person. To my surprise, the Half Moon turned out to be one of those craft beer places, all exposed brickwork and trying too hard. My dad was late, not that I'd really expected otherwise, so I got myself a pint of Monkey's Butthole, which apparently had notes of mango and pineapple, and a toasty bitterness that lingered right to the end, and found a spare table amongst the beards and ironic lumberjack shirts. For a while I sat there, feeling like the sort of person who went out on his own to drink artisanal ales, which, thinking about it, was probably a perfectly respected pastime in the artisanal ale-drinking community. Oddly enough, this wasn't very comforting. Having spent the past half-decade missing deadlines, and then telling myself it was fine because my friends knew where they stood with me, I felt at once angry at my dad for pulling the same shit, and angry at myself for taking so long to realise what a crappy way that was to treat people, and also for being hypocritical about it. My phone buzzed. It was nice to know Oliver was thinking of me, but it was less nice that he'd apparently decided to think of me through the medium of an old, bald white man. What the fuck? I texted. I assume this is a dick. Yes. Should I have any clue what kind of dick it is? It's a political dick. I liked this better when it was a flirty game instead of an actual general knowledge quiz. I'm sorry. Somehow Oliver could even make text come across as genuinely contrite. It's Dick Cheney. How was I ever supposed to get that? Contextual clues. I said it was political. How many dicks are there in politics? To make the obvious joke, loads. There was a pause. It's also an I miss you dick. That's a very specific flavour of dick. You're here, said John Fleming, who was standing over me. I wasn't sure you would be. Speaking of, I typed, Dad's here. Reluctantly, I put my phone away and found, as ever, I had nothing to say to him. Yes. Yes, I'm here. This has changed. He sounded genuinely peeved about it. Can I get you anything from the bar? I had most of a Monkey's Butthole left, but my father had abandoned me when I was three, and making him say Monkey's Butthole to a stranger might be the only revenge I'd ever get. I showed him the bottle. I'll have another of these, thanks. Heading to the counter, he scored the latest in a string of small, annoying victories by simply pointing at the drinks he wanted and somehow making the gesture look dignified and commanding instead of utterly petty.
And then, sporting a second butthole and a pint of Ajax napalm, he made his way back to me. Given this was so clearly not what he'd been expecting, and that he was the oldest person in the building by a good 30 years, he looked infuriatingly non-out of place. I think it was the combination of everyone else trying to dress like they'd been rock stars in the '70s, and that fucking awful charisma that made the world shape itself to him, not the other way around. Fuck, it was going to be a long evening.
"You wouldn't believe," he settled himself across from me, "that Mark Knopfler used to perform right over there."
"Oh, I believe it, I just don't care. Honestly, I'm not even..." Okay, this was a lie, but I wanted to piss him off the teeniest bit. "Completely sure who he is." I definitely misjudged it. Not only did he know I was bullshitting him, but he also wasn't going to let that stop him giving me a long, self-serving rant about the history of the music scene.
"When I first met Mark in 76, he and his brother were both on the dole and thinking about starting a band, so I took them to see Max Merritt and the Meteors here at the Moon. Back then, it was part of what we called the toilet circuit."
The problem with my dad, well, one of the many problems with my dad, was that when he talked like this, you really wanted to listen. "The what?"
"Bunch of dingy as hell venues up and down the country. Pubs, warehouses, that kind of thing. Places you'd play for the beer and the exposure and the love of it. It's where we all got our start in the day. Anyway, I took Mark to see Max Merritt and the Meteors, and what those guys could do with just two acoustic guitars and an electric keyboard. I think that was a real inspiration to him."
"Let me guess, you also said to him, 'Wow, it sounds like you're in dire straits.'" He smiled.
"So you did know who he was?"
"Yeah, all right, I had an idea."
"Of course, it's all different now."
He paused meditatively and took a swig of Ajax napalm.
"This actually isn't bad, though in my day what you call craft ales we used to call beer."
Another equally meditative pause.
"Then the chains took over and the small breweries shut down, and everything was pressurized and standardized. And now we've forgotten where we came from, so a bunch of guys in their 20s are trying to sell back to us something we should have never given away in the first place."
A third pause. He was really good at this.
"It's a funny thing, the pendulum of the world."
"Is that," I asked, half sincerely, half not, "what you're going to call your next album?" He shrugged.
"But that depends on your mother. Your mother and the cancer."
"So, what's up with that? Are you okay?"
"Waiting for tests."
Oh, fuck. For a split second, John Fleming just looked like a bald old man drinking IPA from a fancy bottle. "Look, I'm... sorry about... it must be awful."
"It's what it is. And it's made me think about things I haven't in a long time."
A month or so ago, I would have said, "You mean like the son you abandoned?" "Like what?" I said instead.
"The past, the future, the music."
I could almost pretend that I fit into the past, but it wasn't much comfort.
"You see, it's like the beer. When I started out, we were just kids with big ideas playing on borrowed guitars for anyone who'd listen. Rights of Man recorded our first album on a busted-up 8-track in a garage. Then the studios swept in with their bubblegum pop and their bands of plastic children, and all the dirt and the heart went out of the business."
I'd read interviews with John Fleming, I'd listened to his songs, I'd seen him on TV, so I knew that this was just how he talked. But it was different when it was him and you, and those intense blue-green eyes were looking right at you, and making it feel like he was telling you things he'd never tell anybody else.
"And now,"
he went on, with legendary melancholy,
"we're back in the sheds and the bedrooms, and people are making albums on borrowed guitars, on busted-up laptops, and putting them on SoundCloud and Spotify and YouTube for anyone who'll listen. And suddenly, It's real again, and it's where I began, and where I can never go back to.
For once, I wasn't trying to be a dick, but at this stage, against my better judgment, I was genuinely interested. And how does the whole package fit into this? And for the first time ever, I got a reaction from John Fleming. He looked at his beer and closed his eyes for a long moment.
I can't be what I was, he said. So I have to be something else, because the other option is being nothing. And I could never be nothing. My agent said package would be a good fit for me. Remind my old audience I was there and tell a new audience who I am. It's not a comeback, it's a curtain call. It's standing on the stage with the lights going down and begging the crowd to wait and listen to one last song.
I didn't know what to say. I should have realized I didn't have to say anything. He'd do the talking for both of us.
Everybody tells you that when you're young, you think you'll live forever. What they don't tell you is that when you're old, you think the same. It's just everything starts reminding you that it's not true.
How the fuck had I got here? What was I supposed to do now? You'll never be nothing, Dad.
Perhaps. Except you look back and what have you done?
Like nearly 30 studio albums, countless tours, a career spanning 5 decades. That one time you stole a Grammy from Alice Cooper.
I didn't steal it. I won it, fair and square.
He seemed to cheer up slightly.
And we beat the shit out of each other in the car park afterwards.
See? You've done loads of important things.
But when it all comes round again, who will remember?
I don't know. People, the internet, me, Wikipedia.
You could be right.
Having downed the last of his IPA, he set the bottle down with a decisive clank.
Anyway, this has been good. I should let you go.
Oh, you're going?
Yeah, I'm expected at Elton's for a party. I'm sure you and the boyfriend have a lot to do as well.
Somehow he was making me resent the ending of a meeting I'd resented the start of. Okay, well, this was a thing we did. As he stood, I realized he hadn't even taken his coat off. But then he paused and gave me one of those deep, soulful looks that, just for that moment, made it all okay.
I'd like to do this again, while there's still time.
I'm pretty busy the next couple of weeks. I've got a work due, and it's Oliver's parents' anniversary.
After that, then, we'll go to dinner. I'll text you.
Then he was gone. Again. And I did not know how to feel. I mean, I was pretty sure I'd done the right thing, but apart from that, I wasn't quite sure what I was supposed to be getting out of it. There was no way we'd ever be close. Any chance of that had gone out the window when he'd walked out on me and not come back for 25 years. And, now I stopped to think about it, he'd still expressed no remorse about that, and was clearly never going to. Probably we'd never even have a conversation that didn't center entirely on him. Not that long ago, it had been a point of pride for me to take the fuck all he was offering me and shove it up his arse. But I didn't really need to do that anymore. And I think I liked not needing to do that. Besides, the man was dying. I could listen to a few stories if it helped him deal. The truth was, John Fleming wasn't going to change, and I wasn't going to be important to him in the way I used to think I had to. But I was sort of getting to know him, and I was sort of getting to be there, and that was something. So why not take it? Chapter 40. The day of the Beetle drive, I was in the office from 11 and the hotel from 3. Insurance and table decorations I had sorted, the insurance by a lot of stressed out telephone conversations, and the table decorations by staying up all night making them with Priya and James Royce. But I'd come up blank on music, and I was telling myself that no one would mind because posh people mostly just like the sound of their own voices, When Rhys Jones Bowen poked his head into the cubicle where I was frantically pulling on my formal wear.
"I heard," he said, paying absolutely no attention to the fact I was in my underwear. "You were having a spot of bother in the music department."
"It's fine, we'll do without. We had a string quartet last year and nobody cared."
"Well, if you're sure, I'll tell Uncle Alan we don't need him after all."
I feel like I've missed the middle of this conversation. Who is Uncle Alan and why would we need him or otherwise?
Oh, you see, I was talking to Becky, the volunteer, who was talking to Simon, the volunteer, who was talking to Alex, who was talking to Barbara, who was saying the band you wanted had pulled out and you couldn't get a replacement. So I thought, why don't I ask Uncle Alan? So I rang him up, and he says to me that he and the boys are in town anyway because they're on Songs of Praise and they'd be happy to help us out.
I resigned myself to being trouserless for the rest of the encounter. Okay, Rhys, one more time. Who is Uncle Alan?
You know who Uncle Alan is. I told you about Uncle Alan before. I'm always talking about Uncle Alan.
Yes, but I'm never listening. He rolled his eyes.
Ah, there was me forgetting what a bell end you are. Uncle Alan is the managing director of the Skenfrith Male Voice Choir. They're quite big in male voice choir circles.
And you're only mentioning this now because...
I didn't want to get your hopes up if it wasn't going to come through.
I surrendered to the unstoppable power of Rhys Jones Bowen and his seemingly limitless supply of talented Celts. Fine, can you get them settled in and give them whatever they need? And... I realised with a sinking feeling I was experiencing a moment of genuine gratitude towards Rhys Jones Bowen. Again. Thank you. Sorry I'm a bell end. I really do appreciate your help.
Happy to oblige. Nice boxes, by the way. Are they Marx's?
I squinted downward. I'm not sure I'd track my pants that closely.
Right you are, then.
And with that, he ambled off, presumably to wrangle a choir. I returned my attention to dressing and had, once again, got into the yoga position necessary to get one leg into my trousers without sitting down, falling over, or dropping anything in the loo. Then Alex burst in.
"For God's sake," I yelled, "I'm not a peep show."
Alex seemed unperturbed.
Quick question. You know that one job I had?
You mean the job of not losing the Earl?
Yes, that job.
He paused.
Roughly how inconvenient would it be if I hadn't 100% discharged it to the full extent of my abilities?
Are you trying to tell me you did lose the Earl?
Only a little bit. I don't know exactly where he is, but I have an increasingly comprehensive list of places he isn't.
Please, Alex. I practiced some calming breathing. Just find him. Now.
Rightio. Sorry to, interrupt. Nice boxers, by the way. Very chic.
Go away. He went away. And I began hopping in a small circle, trying to drag my inconveniently clingy trousers over my inconveniently long legs, with their inconveniently bendy knees, when I heard the door open again behind me.
"Alex," I snapped, "please will you fuck off for 5 minutes?"
"Oh, I say,"
said a voice that was much older than Alex's, but not much posher.
"I'm terribly sorry. I think the lock must be broken. Though now you mention it, I have misplaced a chap called Alex. Do you know where he is?"
I shuffled back around, still very much under-trousered, to face the patron and primary donor of crap, the Earl of Spittle Hampstead.
"I'm so sorry, my lord, I thought you were somebody else."
"Yeah, I gathered that, when you called me somebody else's name."
"Ah, yes, how very astute of you."
"I enjoyed the swearing, though. I do like a bit of swearing."
"We strive to please. If you give me 10 seconds to put my clothes on, I'll take you upstairs and we'll find Alex together."
"It's no bother. I'm sure I'll track him down myself."
"No, no," I insisted. "I'll be with you in a moment."
The Earl of Spittle Hampstead was 90 if he was a day, balmy in a way that only the aristocracy were allowed to be, and had a habit of getting into what Alex described as scrapes. The last time we'd let him wander around unattended at the Beetle Drive, He'd taken a wrong turn into the hotel bar, ordered an obscene amount of champagne, just to be polite, and wound up flying to Vienna with someone he'd completely failed to recognize was a prostitute. Apparently they had a lovely time, but it did rather put a dent in our fundraising. 10 somewhat hairy seconds later, I was mostly dressed and shepherding a peer of the realm somewhere vaguely in the direction of where he needed to be, while he told me a long story about an elephant, a racing monoplane, and the time he slept with Marilyn Monroe. We found Alex looking very carefully inside a potted plant. "What?" I began, very much aware that I was about to ask a question to which I might not want to hear the answer. "Are you doing?" Alex looked at me like I'd said something deeply foolish.
"Looking for the Earl, obviously."
"And you thought you'd find him inside a potted plant?"
"Well, I think you've just made yourself look dashed silly, because that's exactly where I found him."
He pointed at the Earl of Spittlehamsted, who hadn't moved from my side for the length of the conversation.
"See?"
"Hello, Twaddle," said the Earl cheerfully. "How's things?"
"Bally awkward, actually. Meant to be looking after this Earl chappie. Completely lost him."
"What rotten luck. Seems you'll have to make do with me instead."
For a moment this seemed to trouble Alex.
"Well, I was doing this little job for Luke, but... well..."
He turned to me helplessly.
"Hillary's a jolly old family friend, so I'd really probably better take care of him if that's all right with you."
I patted his shoulder. "You know, I think that might be for the best."
"Huzzah! Victory for common sense!"
Alex took the Earl's arm gently.
"Come on, old bean. I've got oodles of chaps, and chapesses for that matter. No need to be sexist. It is the 20th century. Simply dying to have a chinwag with you."
"Marvellous," returned the Earl. "One so seldom gets to talk about dung beetles to an appreciative audience. You know, they shot me down in the Lords again. Short-sighted bastards!"
I slumped against a pillar as they vanished into the function room, from within which I could already hear the melodious sounds of a male voice choir warming up with the Welsh national anthem. Chances were this would be the last opportunity I got to droop and catch my breath for the rest of the evening, so I was damn well making the most of it. I did, however, adjust my posture into something approaching respectability, because I was fairly close to the lobby. The guests were already beginning to arrive, and shagged out before you'd even begun wasn't a confidence-inspiring look in a fundraiser. Which was unfortunate, because shagged out before I'd even begun was pretty much how I was feeling. Basically, though, it was fine. Everything had come together. It always kind of did. And if I was being honest, it was nice seeing the whole team weirdly united in their support for our technically important but thoroughly unglamorous cause, to say nothing of the annual treat that was Rhys Jones-Bowen in a suit. And by treat, I meant subtle headfuck, because he always managed to look like an undercover Marxist. Although, speaking of treats of suits, I couldn't quite resist checking out the tuxedo-wrapped piece of manhunkery who'd just come in and was asking the receptionist for directions to the crap fundraiser, and then immediately felt guilty, because I had a possibly actually real boyfriend now. And then the confused opposite of guilty, when I realised the tuxedo-wrapped piece of manhunkery was my possibly actually real boyfriend. I lifted my hand in an "I am definitely not overwhelmed by how hot you are" wave, and Oliver came striding over in a flash of black and white and gorgeous. "You are ridiculously good-looking," I said, attacking him with my eyes. "You know that?" He smiled at me, all jawlines and cheekbones.
"Normally I'd say the same to you, but at the moment you look like you got dressed in a toilet stall."
"Yeah, there's a fairly obvious reason for that."
"Come here."
I came there, and Oliver made a number of swift, certain adjustments to my clothing that I found weirdly sexy, despite being entirely SFW. He even redid my bow tie. And from the front and everything. You had to admire a man with coordination like that. There. He leaned in and kissed me chastely. Apparently, somehow we'd gone from people who needed to practice any sort of physical contact to the ever-challenging appropriate workplace smooch.
Ridiculously good-looking.
I was probably gazing at him pathetically. Well, not ridiculous. Maybe slightly absurd, in the right light.
On the contrary, Lucien, you're always captivating.
Okay, you're sailing perilously close to the wind here. Because if you keep this up, I'll need to shag you in the nearest closet, and I'm technically supposed to be doing my job here.
And? Another of his killing-me-to-pieces smiles. I'm supposed to be helping you with it.
Got to be honest, I'm 50-50 on the job thing right now.
You know that's not true. You've worked very hard for this.
I sighed. Yeah, okay. But you better make it up to me later.
I fully intend to.
Then he slid his arm around my waist, and we went in, together. Chapter 41.
Professor Fairclough's welcome speech ended, as it always did. Please give generously, because coleoptera are, by any objective measure, more important than any of you.
Which, you know, was very her, and I like to think it was part of the crap experience. I mean, at what other high-end fundraiser would you be told to your face that you were worth less than an insect? She stood down to a polite smattering of applause, and then Rhys Jones-Bowen's Uncle Alan and the Skenfrith Male Voice Choir took the stage and began singing soulfully in Welsh about... Well, I didn't know, because it was in Welsh. So, I leaned in to Oliver. We've got about half an hour to an hour of networking before dinner. The trick, basically, is to never look like you're trying to get money out of people, so that they can feel good about themselves when you eventually get money out of them. He frowned.
That sounds rather outside my skill set. If it's all the same to you, I'll stand next to you and look respectable.
Yeah, and if you could occasionally talk middle class at people, that'd be helpful too.
So... Eaten any good quinoa recently? That kind of thing?
Perfect. Just slightly less sarcastic sounding. We circulated. It was mainly, hello, so glad you could make it. How's your business, child, novel, horse type stuff? But occasionally people would want to stop me for a longer conversation, which meant I got to introduce my pointedly appropriate but genuinely wonderful new boyfriend. I was relieved to see that while a couple of our most... How can I put this politely? Traditional donors had stayed away, we'd still done pretty well, at least in terms of turnout. A handful of new developments, including Ben and Sophie, had shown up, and despite all the posturing, most of the concerned about your values crowd appeared to have backpedaled, either because Alex's plan had somehow worked, or because they'd been full of shit from the beginning. So, thanks for that, fuckers. Adam, I bonhomied. Tamara, so glad you could make it. Don't you both look lovely? Adam gave one of his acknowledging nods.
Thank you. The suit's black bamboo hemp.
And this,
added Tamara, indicating her annoyingly gorgeous gold silk kaftan,
is by one of my favourite designers. She's very new, so you won't have heard of her yet, but she runs a Made in Africa social enterprise, working closely with local artisans who specialise in traditional techniques.
I gave her my best smile.
That's so you.
Well, Adam almost looked like he'd never been an investment banker.
You know how Tamara and I believe in living our principles.
Oh, that reminds me, I said. I haven't introduced you to my partner yet. Oliver, these are Adam and Tamara Clark. Adam and Tamara, this is Oliver Blackwood.
Handshakes, air kisses, and entirely one-sided namastes followed.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Oliver had his good-at-social-situations face on.
You're the couple behind Gaia, aren't you?
They both lit up like locally sourced Christmas trees.
Yes.
Tamara's eyes grew soft.
It's been our whole life for 5 years.
Another of Adam's nods.
Our mission's always been to bring ethical values to the convenience food sector.
I clutched at Oliver's hand in a way that I hoped signalled, I'm in real danger of laughing right now, and he squeezed back in a way that suggested he got it.
That's very admirable, murmured Oliver, especially considering how many businesses in that sector have unethical values.
I know, replied Tamara with absolute sincerity. It's terrible.
Adam seemed oddly distracted, considering that their business, and by extension themselves, had always been the clerk's favourite topic of conversation. Then I noticed his gaze kept catching on my hand, still resting in Oliver's. And you know, that gave me a bit of a dilemma. Because, from a certain point of view, it was my job to make these people comfortable. But, from a different point of view, fuck him. I'd jumped through a stack of hoops over the past couple of weeks to satisfy the Adam Clarks of this world, but not holding hands with my boyfriend, my very nice, very respectable boyfriend, who nobody could possibly disapprove of, was a hoop too far. And if Adam and Tamara decided to take their checkbook home because they went to a party and saw two guys being mildly affectionate to each other, well, then they could explain that to all their trendy lefty friends. So, he gabbered himself, Oliver, what is it that you do?
I'm a barrister.
What kind?
Asked Tamara.
Criminal.
That earned an indulgent chuckle from Adam.
The sort that locks up innocent people, or the sort that puts murderers back on the streets? Well, both, but mainly the murderer sort.
Oliver offered a placid smile.
I'd say the money helps me sleep at night, but it's not even that well paid.
If you ever need help finding peace.
Tamara's earnestness could have stripped bone.
I could put you in touch with a number of excellent yogis.
Before Oliver had to work out how the hell to respond to that, Adam chimed in with,
I used to be in a very similar situation myself. I mean, financial sector, obviously not legal. But Tamara really helped me find my path.
Thank you, said Oliver, with an impressive air of meaning it. I'll look you up if I ever feel ready.
They made appreciative, if slightly condescending, noises, congratulated me on the authenticity of the Welsh male voice choir, and finally let us go. I cast Oliver an, I'm sorry, they're the worst, glance, but couldn't risk saying it out loud, just in case they, or let's be fair, anybody else, heard me dissing some people who were about to give me a very large sum of money.
Don't worry.
He leaned in, somehow managing to whisper without looking shady.
If I can pretend to respect Justice Mayhew, I can pretend to like the clerks.
You shouldn't have to.
It's exactly what you needed me for.
Well, didn't that feel all complicated and confusing? Because he was right. Having someone who could convincingly fake an interest in me and my donors had been the whole plan. But seeing it in action, especially now I genuinely liked him, made the whole thing icky. You're better than this.
Better than what, Lucien?
His eyes gleamed softly at me.
Better than being polite to people I don't particularly care about at my partner's work event.
Yes? He brushed his lips against my brow, hiding his smile.
I've got news for you. For those of us not raised by 80s rock legends, this is just life. It's fine. I'm happy to be here with you. And later we can go home and laugh about it all.
When we go home, I told him firmly, there won't be time for laughing. You have no idea how good you look in those trousers. Oh, shit. Across the room, I saw to my horror that Dr. Fairclough was interacting with a guest, which never, ever ended well. I grabbed Oliver by the elbow. Sorry, this is an emergency. We have to go. As we drew closer, trying not to look too much like we were staging an intervention, I realised we were even more fucked than I thought, because Dr. Fairclough was talking to, or rather at, Kimberly Pickles. And the problem with Kimberly Pickles, which I knew well from having painstakingly developed her and her wife over the last year and a half, is that she did not give a shit about Beatles, and she did give a shit about lots of other things. Things that she felt very strongly her incredibly wealthy partner would be better off spending her money on.
can't be sure whether you're being willfully ignorant,
Dr. Fairclough was saying,
or simply
Kimberly, I swept in. How lovely to see you. I don't think you've met my partner, Oliver Blackwood. Oliver, this is Kimberly Pickles, who you might recognise from...
Oh, of course, he said, not cutting over me, but kind of gliding in effortlessly. Your recent miniseries on child sexual exploitation was remarkable.
She beamed, but sadly not in a totally disarmed way, and said,
Oh, thank you,
in the broad estuary accent that 10 years ago would definitely have kept her off the BBC. And this is my boss, I indicated Dr. Fairclough warily. Dr. Amelia Fairclough.
It's so good to meet you.
Oliver didn't bother extending a hand for her to shake, which I initially thought was uncharacteristically impolite. But he must have realised that Dr. Fairclough would have A, not given a shit, and B, seen the requirement to engage in a pointless social ritual as a waste of time.
Lucian's told me all about your monograph on rove beetles.
She subjected him to her... I was going to say her most intense gaze, but her gazes were almost all equally intense.
Has he?
Yes. I was wondering if you could clear up some of the finer points of their behavioural relationship with ant colonies.
My God. Was this what love felt like?
I'd be delighted to.
Dr. Fairclough looked the closest to happy I'd ever seen her, which wasn't very.
But it's an intricate subject, and there are too many distractions here.
Oliver drew Dr. Fairclough gently aside in search of a better rove beetle ant colony interaction discussing location, leaving me awash in gratitude and hopefully better place to salvage Kimberly Pickles.
That Dr. Fairclough,
she began,
is a right cow.
It wasn't language I would have personally used, but I could see where she was coming from. I'm afraid academics can be quite single-minded about their interests.
No fucking kidding. She genuinely thinks that dung beetles are more important than people.
I offered a conspiratorial smile. I'd say you have to get to know her, but no, she genuinely does. She didn't smile back.
And you really think it's right, do you? For people to give their money to you instead of a women's shelter in Blackheath? Or fighting child mortality in sub-Saharan Africa?
Thing is, she wasn't totally wrong. CRAP wasn't a cool charity, and it wasn't even high up on those effective giving lists that help nerdy mathanthropists evaluate exactly how to save the most lives per dollar. But it was my cause, and I'd fight for it, and from what I knew of Kimberly Pickles, she liked a fighter. Well, I said, if I worked for a women's shelter in Blackheath, there'd be people asking me why people should give money to that instead of malaria prevention or deworming initiatives. And if I worked for a charity that tried to prevent child mortality in sub-Saharan Africa, there'd be people who asked me why they should be sending money overseas when we've got problems enough over here. She relaxed a bit, but she still wasn't buying it.
It's fucking dung beetles, mate.
It is. I gave a you-got-me kind of shrug. And although they are ecologically important, I'm not going to pretend we're saving the world here. We're not even saving Bedfordshire. But your missus isn't going to run out of cash anytime soon, and she clearly enjoys throwing it at slightly silly things that make her happy.
She does enjoy laughing at you,
Kimberly admitted. Yes, so do a surprising number of our donors. It's why we've never changed the acronym. Well, that, and because Dr. Fairclough would never let us, because she feels it's the most accurate and succinct description of our operation. That made her cackle like Adele.
All right, but tell your boss to stop insulting donors' wives.
Sorry, what was that about insulting my wife?
Not the best time for Charlie Lewis to rock up. I'd met her through the James Royce Royces, because she and James Royce Royce had briefly worked for the same terrifying investment bank doing terrifyingly complicated mathematics with terrifyingly large sums of money. She was built like a fridge, wore her hair like Elvis, and had glasses like Harry Potter, and right now did not seem happy with me.
It's nothing, babe.
Kimberly turned and kissed her wife on the cheek.
Just the professor being weird.
Charlie gave a heavy sigh.
Not again. Why does she bother trying to talk to bipeds?
I think, I suggested, she feels it's expected of her. If it's any consolation, I know for a fact she hates every second of it.
Maybe I'm not as horrible as you, Luke, but it doesn't help.
I'm helped, Charlie smirked. I like the idea of people who cross my wife being miserable.
Kimberly whacked her affectionately on the arm.
Will you stop being such a 50s patriarch? Which one of us sits in an office all day moving other people's money around with a bunch of prats who went to Oxford, and who spent the last 3 months interviewing coyotes in Central America?
Yes, and you've got back, and an annoying woman is being rude to you at a party.
Yeah, a party you made me come to, because you still want to spend money saving bugs that eat shit.
I hoped this was cute partner banter, not the start of a blow-up that was going to jeopardise their relationship, or, more relevant to me, our donation. As a representative of the shit-eating bug community, I said, we're very glad you're both here. Kimberly made a conciliatory gesture.
I'm all right, really. I like the male voice choir. There's one in Bangor does really good work with disadvantaged teenagers.
Okay. I was pretty sure salvaging had been accomplished. And actually, from what I knew about her, Kimberly wasn't the sort of person who'd sabotage a charitable donation in a fit of pique. If anything, she was the opposite of that sort of person, and in the interests of maintaining independent identities, she and Charlie tended to very pointedly champion different causes. Even so, there were limits, of which insulting your wife to her face about her deeply held beliefs was a fairly obvious one. Obvious, that is, to everybody except Dr. Fairclough.
Let me leave you to it for now, I said. I'd love to catch up after dinner.
Charlie gave me one of those city bastard handshakes.
That'd be splendid. If not, let's do lunch sometime. And give my love to James. There's always an opening for him at C.B. Lewis.
Will do.
Leaving them bickering happily about their various life choices, I took a meandering route past several other important donors to the nook into which Dr. Fairclough had managed to manoeuvre Oliver. She was still, as far as I could tell, talking about the behavioural relationship between rove beetles and ant colonies, and, if I knew her at all, wouldn't have paused for breath in the last 10 minutes. I'd been in Oliver's position myself a bunch of times, because Dr. Fairclough seemed genuinely unable to comprehend that other people might not find beetles as fascinating as she did, and I'd never mustered even half as much poise, grace, or straight-up sincerity as Oliver was showing right now. It was just so fucking heart emoji that I actually had to take a moment. And then I realised that the longer I stood around in a sea of swoon, the longer Oliver was going to have to talk about bugs. So I went to rescue him. Chapter 42.
Using pheromone trails,
Dr. Fairclough was saying. Oliver didn't even flinch.
Oh, how fascinating.
If you're attempting to employ sarcasm, I assure you I'm quite immune to it.
He thought about it for a moment.
I don't know how to answer that without still sounding like I'm trying to employ sarcasm.
She too seemed to think for a moment.
Yes, you appear to have identified a difficult paradox. If it's any help, when I was an undergraduate, my housemates found it convenient to make this signal.
She laid a single finger on her cheek.
To indicate that they were not to be taken seriously.
I shall endeavour to make use of it, but please do continue.
Or, I said quickly, we could go and eat, because they're serving food now. Another thoughtful pause from Dr. Fairclough.
No, I'd rather stay here and talk to Oliver.
I believe...